Welcome back to The Horse Race, your weekly look at politics, policy, and elections in Massachusetts. I'm Stephanie Murray of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook.
And I'm Jennifer Smith, really relieved that among all of the chaos happening in Boston, we have a still and untroubled water at the national level. I am just kidding. Everything is chaos.
Yeah, Jen, is there anything going on right now in Washington, D.C.?
I don't want to talk about it. Actually, I do. I have to, because last week we were just learning that I don't know if you've noticed, there might be an impeachment inquiry.
Yeah, so now we are in the thick of it.
We are in the thick of
it.
We're
in the thick of the beginning of it.
It might be starting. But so if anyone only gets their news from this podcast, they might not have heard about this last week. But a whistleblower complaint expressed a deep concern that President Trump used the power of his office to pressure the president of Ukraine to dig up dirt on Joe Biden's son for Trump's political gain. As you'd imagine, the president isn't taking that well and has been tweeting out all sorts of things, like saying Rep. Adam Schiff should be arrested for treason after the representative riffed on some contents of the call between Trump and the Ukrainian president. So that's a whole situation. I can't imagine it's going to be wrapped up anytime soon. But you know what? That's all we're talking about it today.
And one thing I would say is keep an eye out for Congressman Richard Neal from the 1st District out in Western Mass. He's one of the six committee chairs who is kind of leading this impeachment inquiry.
Yes,
and he was actually
Stephanie.
One of the last members of the congressional delegation to come out in support for impeachment.
Bring it back to the Massachusetts delegation.
Yeah, we always have to have a local angle here.
Hey, but hyper-local, though. We are going to be talking a little bit with Rich Parr about the breakdown from the city council election, but you actually are also in the thick of that.
Yeah, so tonight I am moderating a forum hosted by the Environmental League of Massachusetts for all eight of the at-large city council candidates. We'll be talking about energy and environment at the Boston Public Library. So come on down to that at 5:30 if you're interested. And we have a very exciting live event coming up. Jen, can you tell us what it is?
Yes. So if you happen to miss Stephanie talking to all of the at-large people, you can come see us talking to Congressman Joe Kennedy and Attorney General Maura Healey on October 10th. That's crazy. That's coming up so fast.
I know. It's almost here.
It is. So RSVP, it is free. You can find details at thehorseracepodcast.com. And it's at WeWork. But, and I've talked to a few people who assumed it would be at the WeWork we're normally at. It is not at the WeWork that we are normally at. It's the WeWork at 31 St. James Ave. So it's free.
Put that in your GPS.
Your GPS, just with a little beer emoji next to it, because there is free beer. The event is free, but you should RSVP and come hang out with us there. Please bring a valid ID.
It's going to be so much fun. But for now, Jen, what are we doing here today?
As mentioned, we're going to break down some of those city council election results, but then we're also taking a look at some of the local drama in the state with two returning guests of the pod. Shalene Title of the Cannabis Control Commission is going to talk about Governor Baker's vape ban.
Totally non-controversial.
No, it's fine. No one feels strongly about this at all. No one's like just anxiously smoking in the corner trying to get through this. And so then after that, we're going to talk with Milton Valencia of the Boston Globe, who's going to go a bit deeper into the mess in City Hall right now on the ZBA.
Also non-controversial.
It's fine. It's a very normal, not dramatic week. We're so lucky to live in this state.
All right, let's giddy up.
All right.
The Boston City Council preliminary election is over, and it left behind a trail of data that our Mass Inc. Polling Group Research Director and Western Mass Horse Race Bureau Chief Rich Parr has turned into a series of maps and other charts for WBUR. Rich joins us now to discuss what the map shows. Welcome, Rich.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me on.
So the headline of the preliminary election was that Boston City Councilor Michelle Wu was the top vote getter. What's your analysis on that? I mean, what does it all mean?
Yeah, this is the second election in a row where she's been the top vote getter. I went back and looked for writing the WBUR piece, and I had forgotten that she was actually the top vote getter in the 2017 at-large general election. So this is when we had a mayoral as well. So she actually nipped out Ayanna Pressley, who is now, of course, in Congress. So Michelle Wu continues to show some serious strength in these elections. She won 189 out of the 255 precincts in the city. She won places all across the city. She was strongest in Roslindale and Jamaica Plain, which might be expected. That's kind of her home base. But she was also really strong in the Back Bay. She won places up in Alston Brighton. She won the Seaport. So a really impressive performance from her. She got 20% of the vote And, you know, if you look at the number of votes divided by the actual ballots cast, because remember, you can vote for more than one person for city council in these races, about 60% of the ballots that were cast had Michelle Wu as one of the choices, one of the choices that was selected.
We love us some maps over here, and I was so struck by looking at them that, I mean, you just kind of have this Wu overlay over the entire city. But, you know, coming in right behind her were two other fellow incumbents, Michael Flaherty and Anissa Sibey-George. Their maps looked very different once you took out Michelle Wu's kind of dominance. Where were they strongest?
Yeah, so they came in really close to one another. Anissa Sibey-George ended up finishing about less than 300 votes ahead of Michael Flaherty. But they took very different paths to get there. So if you look at Flaherty to start with, he won more precincts outright than Sibey-George did, mostly around the edges of the map. He was really strong in South Boston and Dorchester down by the water. And down in West Roxbury, he won parts of Charlestown. He won parts of Hyde Park, kind of everywhere that Wu didn't win. You know, Flaherty was picking up stuff. And he really ran up the score in some of those places. So in South Boston, he was topping 30% of the vote, you know, 30, 31, 33% of the vote in some of these precincts. So really, he was getting a lot of his vote from kind of his home base and then these other places he won. If you look at Sibey-George's vote, you know, she did well in her base too, down in Dorchester, but she really got to second place by coming in second in a lot of precincts, like over 100 precincts. She came in second, and then another 60 or so she came in third. So she kind of had a more distributed vote total. So Flaherty strong really in, you know, key places where he won, Sibey-George a little bit more spread out.
And so now that we've got the incumbents out of the way, the candidates who came in fourth and fifth were actually two newcomers, Alejandra St. Guillen and Julia Mejia. So what are their chances of making it onto the council in November? I mean, we should add that there are four seats up and eight candidates.
Right. So, you know, your top three right now are incumbents. And then you have these two newcomers in fourth and fifth, pretty close to one another. I think 1,200 votes separated the two of them, or like one percentage point. So St. Guillen came in ahead of Mejia, and you'd have to say she probably has the best shot of getting that fourth slot in November. She was endorsed by Mayor Walsh. Mayor Walsh endorsed two candidates in this at-large preliminary election. He endorsed St. Guillen, and he also endorsed Anissa Sibey-George. But at the same time, she was also working with Michelle Wu. So Michelle Wu and she and Kim Janey opened up a joint campaign office in Dudley Square. So she was kind of getting a little bit of both sides of that, right? And if you look at her map, she did very well in Mission Hill, Jamaica Plain, parts of the South End, parts of Roslindale. So sort of the progressive overlay, a lot of overlap with Michelle Wu's map there a little bit. Mejia actually beat her through kind of the middle of the city, the Roxbury, Mattapan, parts of Dorchester, parts of Hyde Park. But that didn't generate as many votes for her because, as we often see in these elections, that part of the city just didn't turn out at the rate that some of the kind of the corners of the map, the sides of the map kind of turn out. So I think if you were to have to say, I would say St. Guillen probably has the better chance of making the council in November.
Gotcha. And so kind of the last thing, Rich, before we let you go is going into November, are you seeing any interesting, big caveat, correlation is not causation, but are you seeing any interesting trends that we should keep an eye on?
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting relationship between the votes and the percentage of the votes from the different candidates. So kind of think of Michelle Wu's percentage of the vote in each precinct as your baseline, as your Rorschach test. And what you see is that there's a few progressive candidates where they do better in the places where she does better. And that includes St. Guillen, includes Mejia, includes David Halbert, who came in eighth place. With the other candidates, there's a negative relationship going on here, right? So Flaherty and Aaron Murphy, who came in seventh, and Althea Garrison, who is the other incumbent, who came in sixth behind Mejia and St. Guillen, they actually did better in the places where Wu did worse and vice versa, right? This is a little bit of what we were talking about earlier, where we're saying that you know, Wu was winning all these precincts kind of in the middle. Flaherty was winning stuff, you know, in South Boston and Dorchester, West Roxbury and Hyde Park. So how that kind of splits out in terms of politics and geography will be interesting. Will progressives decide that they all kind of want to vote a slate of progressive candidates with Wu at the top and possibly some of these newcomers on that list? And could she therefore have some coattails to bring some of these people along and maybe get one or two of them onto the council?
All right. Well, now that it's October, I mean, we're officially a month away from the election, so I'm sure we'll be keeping an eye on this pretty closely. Rich Parr of the Mass Inc. Polling Group, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks.
Last week, Governor Charlie Baker took aim at e-cigarettes and vaping products in a pretty broad way. After hundreds of national instances of a mysterious lung illness associated with some forms of vaping, the governor announced a public health emergency and banned sales of such products for 4 months in Massachusetts. And to say it's been controversial would be a bit of an understatement. Three vape shops are suing the state over the ban. They're saying it's unconstitutional and would profoundly harm their businesses. And we're going to get into the ban and its possible consequences right now on the pod. Here with us is Shalene Title, who holds the social justice seat on the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me back.
So almost as soon as this ban was announced, you were a vocal voice of objection. Why?
Well, I think we are all in agreement that there's a pretty serious problem here. The rates at which we're seeing the number of illnesses increase, not knowing the source of it, is really concerning. And I think we all feel we have to find the source of the problem. We have to respond appropriately, I think, through regulation and safety standards. And we don't need a ban to do that. And in fact, I feel that a ban is actually harmful and dangerous, especially when it's so sudden, because you have so many people who use these products. They may be addicted to e-cigarettes. They may be a patient who uses this for medical reasons. And we are then pushing people to use the illicit market, which preliminary evidence shows is exactly the source of the potentially dangerous product.
So officials who are in support of this ban say that people can just use non-vaping products to consume marijuana. I mean, is that a reasonable thing to expect people to do?
Certainly some people may switch. I've talked to medical professionals who suggest that tinctures may be helpful. There's certainly a variety of products. But vaping is a very specific mode of consumption. It's very discreet. There's no smoke involved. So if you're a patient who's trying not to smoke, or you're a doctor who's trying not to advise patients to smoke, it can be useful. Edibles can take up to 2 hours to take effect. So it's not a very easy, simple thing to switch to another mode.
Right. And actually getting to sort of the black market concern as well is, it might seem obvious on its face, but what is the worry if people were to suddenly be unable to buy their normal products at the normal stores and are forced to go elsewhere? What are the risks here?
So we get a lot of criticism at the commission for going slow. But what we have done is we've created this system of regulation that is very strict. Every product is tested. Every product is tracked. So if there's a problem with a product, we can immediately see where it came from. Anything with similar ingredients could be recalled. It could be quarantined. And we can take appropriate measures. The problem with the illicit market is that you don't have any of those controls. And I feel like this is the exact moment when that type of regulation is so critically necessary.
And so you're far from the only voice in opposition to this ban. I mean, there are vape shops in Weymouth, Salem, New Hampshire, Medford, who are suing. What are the voices and what are the opinions that you're really listening to as you kind of gather feedback and figure out what to do next about this?
I really appreciate that question, because for me as a regulator in a public health crisis, it's the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, that has been tracking this since the beginning. I think their advice is really helpful. And then epidemiologists in general, I'm really happy to see that the Department of Public Health is investigating this, is releasing information, because it has to be a coordinated effort. We have to respond. The CCC has to respond in terms of the products, of course, but then also we need law enforcement to be making sure that we're looking for where the dangerous products are coming from and getting them off the street as well. So there's a lot of information that needs to be coordinated.
And actually, to that point as well, the goal of this, ostensibly, the ban itself, is to have some sort of new regulatory framework that is ready to roll out, quote, by the end of the ban, is what the governor said. I think Is that a goal that you're in favor of? I mean, how should the government, in your opinion, on the state level, be rolling out the ideas of new regulation without a ban in place? I guess the question is, like, what's the damage of a delay as opposed to just kind of jumping in with some kind of stopgap measures?
So we have existing procedures in place, as do equivalent agencies that regulate products. So if there's a problem, there can be a recall immediately. We can look into if it does end up being some type of additive or thickener being used in the oil. We can restrict the use of that product. We can develop testing capabilities to make sure that the product is being tested. And I think we need to be in coordination with other states, especially throughout New England, because they are facing the exact same problem. And again, we can do all of that without a ban. And in fact, I think a ban is actually taking away the control that we have.
And what's been the impact of the ban so far? I mean, I think we've all seen like posts online of stores having like prohibition, quote unquote, prohibition sales, or putting all their products into storage or having blowout sales. I mean, what have you seen over the past couple of weeks as people kind of get used to this ban and figure out how to deal with it?
I think there is a feeling of prohibition because it was so sudden. I'm hearing a lot from patients who are very confused because some of these patients, and there's almost 70,000 in Massachusetts, so it's not a small number. And some of them have been using the same product from the same dispensary since 2013. And so to suddenly not know how to switch or what to switch to, it's a big source of confusion for them, and kind of cruel in a way, to be honest.
Yeah. Well, actually related to that as well is how are people engaging with the sort of paradox of being told that this was legal, this was something that they could come to expect would be available in their lives, and then suddenly being told that it's a public health crisis and they aren't going to be able to access it in the way that they've become useful. Is there a worry about this kind of being tied to the stigma of marijuana all over again?
That's a great question. I mean, I think part of legalization is knowing that it would be regulated. So I think it was expected that if we ever saw a problem like this, of course, you would not be able to buy a dangerous product. But it does feel a bit overreaching. For example, there are vaporizer products that use dry flower. So there's no oil, there's no cartridge. It really has nothing to do with the suspected issues causing the illnesses. And those products are banned as well. And it does lead you to ask, what is the evidence that would keep me from buying a product like that, especially for patients?
And the Washington Post had an interesting editorial this morning. I'm not sure if you saw it, but it was in support of the ban, and the thrust of their argument was that giving smokers more options isn't worth getting teenagers or young people addicted to a different kind of smoking, i.e. vaping. What do you think about that?
I think that's a fair point. So there's two different issues here. There is the concern about the severe vaping illnesses. But then on the other hand, there are also very high rates of teen use of vaping. And so then public health professionals are going to discuss, do we want to ban flavored products because those attract teenagers, for example. And I think it absolutely makes sense to have that conversation. It should be a deliberate conversation that's open to public feedback.
Right. And in Massachusetts, the Public Health Committee advanced a bill banning the sale of all flavored tobacco just one day after the emergency declaration. And then House Speaker Robert DeLeo said comprehensive legislation on the matter is in the works. So what do you think about those steps? Do these work in concert with kind of broader regulation?
Yes, I think the relevant question, or one of the relevant question, is will people then stop using that product, or will they then go to the illicit market? And I don't know the answer to that with regard to flavored products. I think it's a fair question. I think there are a lot of lessons that can be learned if you look at tobacco control over the years. But again, that's something that shouldn't happen in one day.
Right. And I think the last thing we're going to ask before we let you go is you've had a pretty busy summer so far over at the CCC. You've just pushed through a whole bunch of potential new regulations. Can you give us the Cliff's Notes version of those?
It feels like it was 100 years ago. I believe it was 1 week ago. I encourage people to take a look at masscannabiscontrol.com. We have new regulations on delivery, on social consumption, if a legislative fix addresses it. And we also have many operational procedures in place to help with applications for small businesses.
All right. Well, we will be keeping an eye on this. Cannabis Control Commissioner Shalene Title, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Boston's Zoning Board of Appeals has gone from a little-known part of city government to the center of a scandal after a bribery situation on the board rocked City Hall. In some ways, the Zoning Board is built in a way that breeds conflicts of interest, according to a Boston Globe report. Here to break it down is Milton Valencia, City Hall reporter at the Boston Globe.
How you doing?
Thanks for joining us. So can you bring us up to speed on what is going on with the Zoning Board? I mean, this has been a pretty big summer and now fall for this board.
It really is, and it kind of came out of nowhere. This is Friday right before Labor Day weekend. It was Friday evening, just before 5, everyone's heading home. I think half the newsroom was empty at that point, where there was an announcement that John Lynch, he is a BPDA worker, longtime city employee, he was about to plead guilty to an information, meaning he was admitting to a crime of bribery, for taking $50,000 to help a developer secure a favorable zoning board vote. And so there was no other information, no other implications of any particular person in those court records. But what it suggested right away is that this is a person who didn't work for the zoning board, didn't work for that side of the city administration, but somehow had some type of influence and was able to influence a zoning board decision in some way. And there was information in the court records that directed to one particular member. So it raised a lot of questions of who was that member. And what kind of influence did Mr. Lynch have over that member? And it raised a lot of questions because this is one of the boards. It's really the gatekeeper to a lot of the things that's happening in the city. We're talking about a big building boom, and a lot of these decisions are being made. So this is a board that's under the magnifying glass already, and it raised a lot of questions about what's happening within it and where we go from here.
And then it really kind of spiraled out from there. There's two additional people that have been involved with the city, and particularly zoning, the zoning board, that aren't specifically accused of anything, but one of them has stepped down, and two of them have stepped down, actually.
Yeah, this happened really rapidly because, again, it raised a lot of questions for a lot of people. What happened at the zoning board? Who was involved, and how far does it go? And those questions weren't immediately answered, and Mayor Walsh it prompted Mayor Walsh to commission an independent study by Brian Kelly, former federal prosecutor, head of the public corruption unit, to look at exactly what the implications were in those court filings. But again, we talked about the bigger picture, about this is a board that's been under the magnifying glass. A lot of neighborhood complaints about this board, about the processes and the way things work. So the mayor has ordered a separate independent review about that process as well. And as we look at this, we've had two situations happen in the meantime. We've had Craig Galvin, a Dorchester-based realtor who was a member of the board. He stepped down saying he wanted to really just focus on his professional career as the board heads in a new direction. And we had William Buddy Christopher, who was head of the ISD at one point, the Inspectional Services Department, for much of the Walsh administration. He stepped down as well. Now, Mr. Christopher's involvement here is he was, as head of the ISD, he oversaw the staff, the department that responded administratively to the zoning board. He also, as we reported more on the project, the Boston Globe reported that the project at the center of this was a South Boston condo development at 8th Street, and it turns out that Mr. Christopher, in his previous life before joining the administration, was actually the original architect for this project. So his name is all over the filings, and I think the mayor would tell you that as he looks at this as an independent review about what happened and where we go from here, I think it was best to see Mr. Christopher take a step back and kind of really examine where we are.
Yeah, I think it can be confusing for some people to kind of hear all of these things pan out, and it just feels like, well, something went terribly wrong. Is it corruption? Is it the way that boards normally work with kind of transactional relationships between developers or people on them? Help us break down a little bit what goes beyond the normal functioning of the ZBA here. Like, if everything feels a little bit strange and unsettling, what actually should people be paying attention to when they're trying to parse out where potential wrongdoing could be?
I think the fact, and we have to examine what the wrongdoing is with Mr. Lynch and his possible involvement. We've reported that only one board member had involvements with, you know, business transactions with Mr. Lynch, and that was Mr. Galvin. And we reported that, and Mr. Galvin stepped down aside. But the bigger picture issue is this is a board that really is probably one of the more controversial boards at this time in the city. There's a lot of development happening, a lot of neighborhood concerns about transparency within the board and the processes within the board. Again, we were looking at minutes and recorded minutes and videos, and they don't add up. So there was a lot of record keeping issues. And I think that there's this resonance within the community that there's been a lot of questions and lack of faith, I guess, with the processes of this board. So that within itself warrants a good review. And as we look at this, we have to see who's on the board, the processes, the way it works. And this is a board that's set up under it's set up under Massachusetts laws, but old Massachusetts laws, antiquated, and really kind of, I think it's a dated process where board members come from certain realms or levels of expertise that in many ways just makes, you know, sets up the potential of conflicts just by very nature of their work. In Mr. Galvin's situation, you have a realtor who brings that level of expertise to the board while he's working in the real estate industry. And does that set up, you know, potential, you know, incestuous mechanics, I think we called it. Is that ripe for conflict? I think some people would say yes, it is, or at least it warrants greater scrutiny. That's at the least. And it's not just that position. There are members of the trade union on this board, and there are architects on this board who are appointed by the nature of their expertise, but that should that be the case? And does it make it more ripe for conflicts? And I think that's one of the things that we were trying to look at, not any one particular member, but the bigger process. And I think now that we're at this situation where there are a lot of questions at this board, I think the mayor wants to look at this. We've already heard city councilors look at this. And I think there are a lot of concerns, not because of any particular red flags, but just because of the potential for it. I think a lot of people are seeing this right now.
And so, like you said, the board is under so much scrutiny right now. What are the consequences that the players who have already stepped down or stepped aside, I mean, what might they face, and how serious is what these allegations are? Like, how serious would the consequences be for them?
Well, there are with Mr. Lynch's case, we know that he pled guilty to charges that this is a plea agreement in which he's agreeing to serve 48 months in prison. That's not much of a deal. He's admitting to some wrongdoing here. So it raises the question, a real question, of what was happening. I think a lot of people, there are two independent investigations that are going, and I hope they'll go a long way towards explaining what happened and how those people should be held accountable if they need to be, or how the board itself should be held accountable if it needs to be. And I think those are the questions that I think we're all looking for.
Right. And to something that you gestured at a little while ago with city councilors and their reaction to it, and what I think is now becoming a very common sentence in Boston, is Michelle Wu has some opinions about the way that the city is being run. What is she calling for right now?
Well, I think this is where we are in the city of Boston, where we're seeing a council push real hard and push back against the administration like we've never seen it before. And this is an opportunity for them to do that as well. We've heard Michelle Wu call for a reorganization of the zoning board, but it doesn't end there. It was President Andrea Campbell calling for an independent auditor or investigator to oversee the city administration in general. She says she was longing to propose this, but it comes as this zoning board is under scrutiny. So we're seeing that coming from a city councilor proposing an independent third-party investigator over the administration.
And those were the last two council presidents, too, is also worth noting, as Michelle Wu was the prior one, and
exactly.
Andrea Campbell's the current.
And we have Lydia Edwards now, who just proposed also her own reorganization of the zoning board. So I think it speaks to the questions and the concerns about the board itself. There are a lot of people who have been looking at this and saying, for a while we've been looking at this, and for a while we've been talking about these problems. I think it speaks to that. But it goes back to the bigger picture of, we've had a council that has pushed harder against this administration or any administration than we've seen in recent times. And this is an example of them taking productive action. The mayor has his own independent review happening at this time. The councilors have their own views. Where we land, I don't know. But I think it's that conflict, or at least that the bigger inner workings of city government, the clash of two branches that we're seeing at work. And I don't think we've seen it this evident before.
Is there an argument for keeping the zoning board the way it is and just kind of keeping an eye on it? Is anybody saying that it should stay the way it is now?
I think you need the zoning board. There's so much happening, and one of the things the administration wanted to make sure to happen was that we would continue with this work of overseeing developments. This isn't just big towers that we're talking about. These are you know, families that are adding, you know, renovations to their apartments so they can bring in in-laws. There are small projects, there are big projects, but there are projects that need to go forward. So I think we need a zoning board in place to oversee that, and we also need some type of zoning kind of guidance in place to kind of serve as that guidance and serve as that blueprint for the city and where the city wants to go. But I think you need something in place. It's just a matter of what that should look like. And I think that what the mayor would tell you, last time I was here, we were talking about Brissett and Sullivan and the City Hall extortion case that hovered over the administration. It has been a busy summer. And that case is still ongoing. We know it's before a judge. There was a lot of controversy about this case. And it's still ongoing. And a lot of people don't feel they did anything wrong and still don't. And so they still have a measurement of support. And, you know, as much as it affected the administration was still going forward. This is a bribery scandal at City Hall. Have no doubt about that. There is a situation where we don't know about the zoning board. We want to look at the processes of the zoning board and some of the implications that were mentioned in court records. But again, you have a longtime city employee pleading guilty to taking a $50,000 bribe, and he's going to jail for 5 years under a plea agreement.
Well, I'm sure we'll need you back soon as this all moves forward. Milton Valencia, City Hall reporter at the Boston Globe, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, so we have a dual part situation to close out the pod this week. Last week, we asked you what year Massachusetts passed its first state education law, and we got a few people who answered this, which was 1789, but I don't know how many people just knew this off the top of their head, Stephanie. I suspect we may have some Googlers.
It's a very Googleable question. That is how I found it in the first place.
And instead of trivia for this week, Stephanie, why don't you give us a rundown of all of the folks right now in, MA04 or MA4?
Okay, so it's hashtag MA04, but the zero is silent when you say it.
Why don't you tell
but
us?
But the number of candidates running is certainly not zero. Jesse Mermel, formerly the chief at the Alliance for Business Leadership, just got in the race. There was a column in the Globe for Newton City Councilor Jake Auchincloss, who is looking at a run. And then already in the race, we have Alan Casey, who is the founder of City Year, Newton City Councilor Becky Walker Grossman, and Treasurer Deb Goldberg has filed with the FEC as she considers a run.
All right. Well, that's our something to watch for the near future, forever future. But for now, I am Jennifer Smith.
And I'm Stephanie Murray, author of the Politico Massachusetts Playbook. This is a reminder to subscribe to the newsletter. Our producer is Libby Gormley, and we'll see you guys next week.